So we have done quite a bit of dependent origination. We only done 4 factors out of 12, but actually we've done the most profound one, most difficult ones, and a lot of what remains is really just repetition of what we have done so far. So we've done what really kind of the core essence of this thing, and now we will have a look at the rest, which should be relatively quick compared to what we have done so far. I've got all the questions here. I will do the questions this evening, so if you have more questions, please continue writing them. So, we'll just see what happens with us later on. That is all about nama rupa, name and form, experience and consciousness, and how they condition each other. One of the similes used in the sutta is the simile of 2 sheaves of straw, and 2 sheaves of straw leaning against each other, and they only stand up if they're both leaning against each other. You take one away, the other one pulls away as well, and just the idea that they cannot exist independently is really the idea of that metaphor, of that simile. So then, once we have established consciousness together with nama-rupa, experience and the content of experience and awareness itself, the rest comes from that. And what the first thing that comes from that, according to dependent arising, are the 6 sense bases. The 6 sense bases being the 6 senses, and these are a natural part, in a sense, of the world of experience, right? We cannot experience things without the 6 sense bases, and they are part and parcel of this thing we call nama rupa. So, so they are basically just an extension of the idea of nama rupa, and then because we have 6 sense bases, because that allows us to contact the world, to get information from the world, to experience the world, happens through the 6 senses, then the result of the 6 sense bases is contact itself. Contact is nothing other than experiencing the world, right? So when you contact the world, that is what is meant here. It comes through the 6 senses, and then it also goes to the mind itself. That's what contact is, just the availability of a sensual input so you can actually experience the world outside of you. So contact is, I think, one of the fairly important factors in dependent origination. And it is probably good to talk a little bit about what that means and how it actually works, and how that affects our inner life. And there's 2 aspects to contact. Contact, of course, it needs a sense base, right? You have to have, the sense has to be there. So you have an eye, and you have the whole apparatus around the eye, which allows the signal from the eye to reach your brain and all this kind of stuff. That's kind of the, what is called the chakku indriya, which is the faculty of seeing, the ability to see itself. But then there is another aspect to this whole thing called contact. That's just the physical aspect of contact. There is also a mental aspect. When you see something, not only does it have to go through the eye, through the apparatus of seeing things, but it also has to be interpreted by the mind, right? So the first thing is what they call impingement contact, whereby the whatever object it is that comes into range of your eye or of your ear or whatever, that impinges on the senses, it makes contact on the sense. There's something called designation contact, which designates, which decides what it is that you are seeing. And that is done by the mind. So impingement contact and then designation contact. And designation contact actually is what helps you to make sense of the world, right? The mind will designate it. You know, we were talking about before, a person can be designated as friend, or enemy, or neutral, or maybe something completely different, right? This is designation contact. Or just what you're seeing around you, you're designating things, you know, you're seeing chairs and cushions and carpets and whatever else it is. This is the mind doing its work on the basic impingement on the senses. And that, of course, is is interesting, because what that means is that contact is not just a passive reception of something, not a passively receiving the world from the outside, and that being aware of that, it is an activity that we do on the impingement itself, on the contact, on the world itself. So we are operating on that world. We have a say in how we are experiencing the world. Depending on how we have been conditioned as people, we experience the world in different ways. No two people experience the world in exactly the same way. I'm sure you all, it's very obvious, right? We all know that that's the case. Sometimes we like one person, somebody else don't like them, or for somebody else they're neutral, right? We experience things in very different ways. And that is because the mind, the mentality, which receives that contact through the senses, will work differently on that object depending on the makeup of that mind. So if your consciousness is, you know, talking about before, about consciousness being at different levels, right? So if your consciousness is like a low level, you're kind of an angry, resentful person, right? And you're kind of fed up with the world and you're angry with everybody. Sometimes you meet people like that who really, you have a grudge against the world. And, you know, you can see how you can get into that perception, right? If you start looking at all the faults all the time, you can see why people get into that kind of idea. Sometimes we all feel a bit like that, right? And if you could develop that, eventually you will have a grudge against everything. That's just the way the mind works. Of course, when they see people, they will tend to see bad things. They will tend to see negative things. When they see the world, they see whatever, they will see things in a darker way. The lower your level of consciousness is, the less beautiful the world is. The less dull everything seems, the less boring everything seems, the less colorful are the colors, the less beautiful are the shapes. Everything is kind of reduced as a consequence of your mental state. But if you are more of a happy kind of character, you see the positive in other people, you see the positive in the world, and if you do see somebody negative, you are forgiving, and you are compassionate, and you are understanding instead. If you have positive mental qualities, your consciousness is at a higher level, the way you receive the input through the senses is different. And your world actually looks like a more beautiful place, right? Everything looks more beautiful, people look more friendly, the colors are more powerful, the roses are more beautiful, the sky is more blue, right? Everything kind of comes out. And you know, you may have experienced that yourself, if you come out of a meditation which is peaceful or whatever, or quite, you know, deeper than the normal state of consciousness, when you come out, things actually look better. The world is you know, the sounds are more beautiful, everything is better around you. And this is what we're doing here. So contact is not a passive thing. Contact is actually a creative act on our part. And we are creating our experience when we contact the world as such. And that's actually nice, right? That's actually quite good, because it means that we can take some responsibility for how we experience the world. If we realize that this is the case, by developing ourselves, we actually see the world in a more beautiful way. And it's not as if we are just passive recipients of all the badness in the world. No, we are actually creating the world right now by how we develop our minds. So it's actually a nice way of looking at our experience of the world. This is how contact then works. And of course, then based on that contact, once you contact the world, you also feel the world, right? The world, whatever experience you have, experience feels positive. It's a good experience, or it's a bad experience, or it's a neutral experience. The three types of feelings, Vedana, according to the how dependent arising works. Right? So if you contact things with a negative mind state, with a negative attitude, you tend to have a lot of negative Vedana. But if you contact exactly the same world with a positive mind state, you have a lot of good Vedana, happy feeling instead. Right? So by developing your mind, your feelings change as well. The feelings are always moving. This is not a passive thing that you have to have lots of bad feelings. Actually, it depends on how you develop yourself. So feeling is one of these very important factors in dependent arising, because basically it is feeling that tends to impel us to act in one way or another. Feeling is what drives us, right? It drives us to then decide what we want to pursue in the world. Everybody wants to have pleasant feelings and want to avoid the bad feelings. So for this reason, both the bad feelings causes craving in us. And the good feelings cause craving, because the bad feelings, they say, I want to get rid of that. And the good feelings, they then create a craving to have more of those good feelings. It's very simple, right? It's very obvious. So you can see this kind of psychological mechanism in each one of us, how it operates. So again, from contact, you know, the contact will vary from person to person, depending on how we do things, and then the feelings will depend on the contact, and then the craving will follow as a consequence. So if you experience many good feelings, the craving will be different from the person who experienced many bad feelings, for example. But in either case, it is craving. And then you crave for things, you desire things, and because you desire things, you want to manipulate the world around you to be able to fulfill those desires, be able to satisfy those desires. Desires want to be satisfied, and the way we do that is through the next factor of the path, which is upadana, often translated as clinging. It can also be translated as attachment. Another way of translating it is simply as taking up, right? We take things up, we start to do things. You know, it can be taking up Buddhism, right? It's always interesting, why is anyone a Buddhist? Why are you interested in Buddhist teachings? Basically, it's because you think there's some happiness to be had in Buddhism, right? That's the reason. Otherwise, you wouldn't be here. If you thought Buddhism was a lot of rubbish, just full of suffering, you wouldn't bother with being a Buddhist. So that is also just one of those taking up. You take up the Buddhist teachings. And sometimes what you get from the Buddhist teachings are very different from what you thought when you started out. That's certainly the case for me. When I started out, I thought, yeah, this sounds cool, right? I'll try this out. And over the years, my view of what Buddhism is has really changed enormously. And it's still changing to the present day. It changes all the way till you reach full awakening. So this changes along the way. But anything we take up, right? You take up living in a house. If you're a monk or a nun, you take up living in a small hut in the forest, right? Or you take up a relationship, or you decide to be celibate, or you take up a university education, or you don't do that, or you take up a job, or you take up pursuing certain types of sensual pleasures, or whatever it is. All of these things are things we take up, and we take them up so that we can satisfy the cravings in life. And you can see, by taking all of these things up, what we are doing is that we are starting to live in a certain way. We have a certain type of existence, right? If you have a house, you have a job, you have a family, and there are certain types of sensual pleasures that you enjoy, you like to listen to, I don't know, classical music, or you like to listen to rock music, or whatever it is, right? Then that becomes like a behavior pattern. You live in a certain way, and your mind is always inclined in that direction, inclined towards that. Inclined, you know, that's why if your house burns down, you get upset, very upset. If you can't put on your beautiful classical music when you get home from work, that upsets you too, because you need that to, you know, chill out a little bit, relax a little bit after work, which is perfectly fine, of course. So you can see there that there is an attachment. You know that you have taken something up. When it's taken away from you, you suffer as a consequence. So all of these things are things that are there to support us, right? Certain foods. People often have exactly the same thing for breakfast every day, right? I don't know what you have, toast or cornflakes or whatever. And you have taken up eating the cornflakes. That makes you makes you happy. So this is how this works. We take up, we attach to these things. They become the source through which we satisfy our desires and cravings. So sometimes we just hope we're taking up the right thing. If you take up the wrong thing, it may not lead in the right direction, right? This is one of the great things, I think, about taking up Buddhism, is that hopefully that will lead us, at least to some extent, in the right direction. If you take up, becoming some kind of terrorist, that's usually a bad idea. It's not going to lead you in the right direction. So you have been deluded, and then you go in the wrong direction as a consequence. So this is how it works, right? You feel things as a consequence of feeling. We are feeling beings. This is like a given. This is like an axiom. You can't really say much about that. We feel. Because we feel, we desire, we crave. Because we crave, we construct a world around us that satisfies that craving, like strategies to satisfy the craving. We cling to that. We attach to that. We take it out. Upadana. And then through all of this, we live in a certain way. Our mind is aiming at certain things, right? This is the sankharas again, the second factor of the dependent arising. The sankharas are an inclination of the mind. The mind is pointing in a certain direction, pointing towards all of these things that we are taking after. And because it's pointing there, we are creating karma, right? Consciousness stays at that level then. And that's where we tend to be, unless we do something with our life to change the way we are, to change who we are, we stay there. This is what we do. And we stay there, and we stay there. And then one day, we die, right? Life is finished. And then you think back, you think, what was the point of all that? I've lived all those years, right? I have kind of done all of these things. I don't know what everybody else does. Everybody else does this, right? They have family, they have kids, they have, and they go to work, and they work really hard, and one day they die. And then you think, why? What was the point? You know, did I do this just because everybody else does it? What was the point of all this? And I think that's what many people feel when they pass away. They wonder what life was all about. What was, you know, why did I do all of these things? And this is one of the things I think that anybody who is practicing some aspect of spirituality, of self-development, of improving themselves, they want to avoid that. They want to actually go somewhere in their life. They want to be a different person when they die than when they started out. So they don't sit there on the deathbed thinking, why, what is this all about? And it kind of leaves you with this empty feeling inside, right? You haven't really spent your life in a useful way. You haven't gone anywhere. You're the same person when you pass away as when you started out. It's not a good feeling, it's kind of an empty feeling. And then this is exactly, I think, what we're trying to avoid. And this is what we're doing here in dependent origination. We're trying to change our bhava, the existence. We're trying to, instead of just being stuck in a particular way of existing, which is this tenth factor of dependent arising, we're trying to change that, to become different, to lift ourselves up, to exist in a new way, to incline towards new things that are more wholesome, that are better, that are more fulfilling, more complete. Which we give up this feeling of always being inadequate or having this craving or this itch inside of us, which is always there and always problematic. And you move towards something more better instead. This is what life is all about, right? As far as I can see, that's what life really is all about. But it's so easy to kind of get drawn into the mainstream of society and do what everybody else does. And it's so easy to kind of get stuck in that, unless there's something which kind of pulls you out and draws you in a different direction. I remember when I became a monk, and my parents were aghast, right? What? What are you doing with your life? You must be, you're crazy. You know, you have everything in life. You know, you have a good education. You have, you know, absolutely everything. We've kind of helped you along the way, and everything is well. My family is not poor or anything like that. So it's like, you know, why? Because they were kind of expecting that I would do what everybody else does, right? And then they could have grandkids and all those kind of things, right? Very happy. Fortunately, I have a brother and sister who have sort of that part out, so that's fine. But the strange thing is that although my parents, my brother, he was always very supportive, but my parents, although they were very kind of upset initially, and they really didn't understand what I was doing. They didn't know anything about Buddhism. They thought I was disappearing into some kind of cult, be brainwashed or whatever, never seen again for the rest of their life, something like that. But once they started to understand what Buddhism was about, took a long time, took a very long time, but once they started to understand, they changed completely, right? And today, I would say my parents are basically Buddhist. I mean, if you ask them, they might not say that they are Buddhist, but, you know, essentially, they come to me and ask me questions about the Dhamma, about how to meditate and all those kind of things. And I'm sort of taken a bit aback when that happens. But it's actually very nice, because it's one of the things it says in the sutta, this great blessing to have a child who goes forward and becomes a monk or a nun, because it affects everybody, and it affects the people closest to you more than anyone else, precisely because they're close to you. So these days, you know, it has changed so dramatically, so enormously. Sometimes you need a shock in your life. When you get that shock, it kind of wakes you up. When you get a son who becomes a monk, wait a minute, what's going on here? And it wakes you up, right? And your life takes a turn for the better as a consequence of that. So if you ever have a child who wants to become a, a monk or nun or a parent, perhaps whatever it is, then, you know, don't discourage it. Think, wow, great, this is going to be a resource, right, for the family and for everybody else. What a wonderful thing that is. We need more such people in the world. So be very positive about that. I have just seen the transformation in my family. It's been absolutely astonishing. It's very positive and very encouraging when that happens. And then, of course, we don't die, right, feeling, whoa, what was this all about? We feel we have fulfilled the purpose of life. We have actually done something with our life that was worthwhile. And because of that, we die contented. We die pleased with ourselves. We haven't wasted our time. And that is so important. And then, because you have changed your status, right, lifted up your consciousness and your mind, then when you get reborn in the next life, jati, 11th factor of dependent arising, when that jati happens, then you get reborn again according to that state of consciousness that you have developed. This is the same principle I was talking about before at the beginning of dependent origination. Exactly the same principle. And you get reborn. And what is the definition of being reborn? It does not mean kind of, you get reborn into some different level of mind or anything like that. You get reborn, into kind of a mental hell or a mental heaven. It does not mean that. Whatever some people might say, what it means quite clearly, it says in the suttas here that it means reborn as a bird in the order of birds, reborn as a human in the order of humans, reborn as a deva in the order of devas. It means ordinary and rebirth. It doesn't mean anything else, not some kind of metaphor or some kind of something like that at all. It's a literal meaning. And when you get reborn, what happens? You become old and you die, right? And you take up this whole dukkha khanda, the whole pile of suffering that comes as a consequence of that. That is what it says there. The whole mass of suffering originates as a result of being born into the world. And what is that mass of suffering? It is just the five khandas, just the five personality groups, and nothing apart from that. And those personality groups will ebb and flow depending on how you live your life. So that is really dependent arising. I think that's probably good enough as far as the main sequence is concerned. And I want to talk maybe tomorrow, maybe now, I'm not sure, about some of the other aspects which kind of come around dependent arising. But this is the main thing. So just to remind you, what this shows you, it shows you very simply that if you have delusion in the mind, if you have a certain amount of ignorance, it must lead to suffering as a consequence via rebirth. The idea of rebirth is fundamental here. And one way of understanding why rebirth is fundamental is to think of the first three factors of dependent arising. In the first three factors you have ignorance. Delusion leads to creation, right? It's creative forces in the mind. The creative forces then lead to consciousness. Now, the moment you end that delusion and you actually start to see things in the right way, then those creative forces also end. You don't create those forces anymore because you know that there's nowhere really to go. So those creative forces stop. When the creative forces stop, consciousness must stop. Right? This is the whole point of the cessation aspect of dependent arising. Once the first one stops, the other one stops afterwards. But you know that when ignorance stops in this very life, it doesn't mean that you die straight away, right? It doesn't mean that consciousness disappears straight away. There are such beings as arahants, people who are fully awakened in this world. And those arahants, they hang around for a while before they pass away. So consciousness is still there. Right? Until the person dies. This is one way of understanding why rebirth is included in dependent arising. Because the consciousness takes a time before it passes away. So that is what it is about. And now, Maybe we could do some of the questions now, because there are so many questions here. If I start this evening, I might not be able to go through them all. So maybe this is a good time now to start these things. We have about half an hour, or maybe that would be nice, and then we can, and then tomorrow we can start afresh with some of the other aspects that I was thinking of. Is that a good idea? Yeah? Is that okay? Yeah. Are we happy with that? Okay, great. So let's have a look at the questions. Okay, number one. Okay, please explain the five khandas. Okay. so the five khandas, I think I already tried a little bit to explain it a little bit before. I'm probably going to do it fairly briefly. The five khandas are basically your experience, right? Right now, you are experiencing the five khandas. These are what I would call the five personality groups. I don't like the idea of the five aggregate subject to clinging. I find that too kind of convoluted, too unclear. Five personality groups is a nice way of looking at them. Five aspects of what it means to be a human being. That's what you're experiencing now, right? What are you experiencing now? You are experiencing feelings, right? So, I don't know what kind of feelings you are experiencing. If you've been sitting on the floor for a long time, maybe you experience a bit of pain, right? I don't know. I hope not, but maybe you are. Or you are experiencing kind of, you know, feeling good about what's going on. Or you are thinking, you know, if you are enjoying the talk, you think, oh, well, you know, this is nice. If you don't enjoy the talk, maybe you're feeling a negative feeling about it. It's okay, you know, if you really don't mind the talk, you are always allowed to leave. You don't have to, I'm not going to take it that you're leaving because of the talk, but my point is just that there's nothing compulsory about having to sit here during these talks. It's really up to you, whatever you want to do. So that's the feeling, right? How do you feel about things? Positive, negative, or neutral? It does not mean emotions, khandas. It means the feeling tone of experience. And that feeling tone changes all the time. And as I was saying before, when you go into meditation, you find that feelings start to disappear, right? The coarser feelings disappear, more refined feelings arise as a consequence. Feeling tone of experience. Then we have sanya. Sanya is a very large group of how we experience the world, right? So right now, you perceive things, right? What are you perceiving? You know, when I see lines, I see chains holding the lights, holding into a ceiling, right? I see a high ceiling with all kind of beams, which is white, and a projector over here. All of these things are perceptions. It's the way that you make sense of the world. You're perceiving things. But it's not just the things that you see, it's also things that you project onto the world. As I was saying before, friends or enemies, right? This is also a perception. It's the way that we use our mind. All of these things are very flexible. They're not set in stone or anything like that. They are flexible things. So perception is all about how we make sense of the input that comes into us, or even the things that are already inside of us. And then you have the volition, the will, sankhara khanda. Again, you can see this word sankhara again. It's a second factor of dependent arising, and it is the fourth aggregate of the five aggregates. So sankhara means the same thing in the khanda as it means in dependent arising. It is the will, right? It is our doing, my body, speech, and mind, what we will in the world, the volition, basically. And then there is consciousness. Consciousness is just awareness itself. So the ability to be aware, right? Ah, okay, you know that, you know, you have this knowledge. And without awareness, everything else becomes defunct. It doesn't work. And then there is the last aggregate, which is rupa, which is basically the material facets of existence. Right? So when we sit here, material facets is like the body, the physical body is a material facet, right? It can also be objects that you see, can also be considered a material facet of existence. It is a mixture of perception and material aspects. When you, you know, these material facets can be very refined. You can even go to if you get reborn in a very refined state, these material aspects will be much more refined than they are in the human realm. So there's a large number of different types of material aspects to our existence. But basically, materiality is what it's all about. But remember, it's what you're experiencing now, right? It's very, it's very real. It's not some kind of artificial category. It's about our experience and how our experience changes all the time. What is changing is the five kansansa. And especially you can see that during the meditation experience itself. It's important to bring all of these things back to reality to actually have a meaning for us. If they don't have any meaning, if we become purely artificial categories, then basically it's not very useful anymore. Okay, so I hope that helps. And if it doesn't, please complain and we can hopefully sort it out later on. It's okay to complain. I'm not going to take it personally here. Okay. Question. Okay. On establishing consciousness of Bodhisattva teaching, when understanding the dependent origination and have penetrated insight, mindfulness to be liberated from the autopilot conditioning, can you not use a team? Gee, this is hard to understand. Condition, can you not use anti-practice without re-establishing consciousness? Adjust, what is that? Can you not adjust? No. Okay, maybe I will leave that one aside.
Can I explain it?
It's yours, isn't it? Okay, please explain it, yeah.
So the teacher, I think you asked this before, the teacher you do it.
Yeah.
You know, so you don't just cease to drop out and cease to exist. So what sort of consciousness do you establish as a teacher when you're penetrating the Dharma and having insight?
Okay, so you mean if you are fully awake person that we're talking about?
Yeah.
Exactly. So I did like to ask that before, precisely. So the idea is that it only ceases the moment that, upon rebirth, right? When you die, that's when it actually ceases. And consciousness is almost like it is bound with the body. As long as you have a body, as long as you have a physical existence, the mind is bound to that. And then when you let body, that comes to an end, and there is no basis anymore for the consciousness to be reestablished, because the mind is not inclining anywhere. You know, it doesn't have an inclination to any particular existence anywhere.
So that's a teacher, and nobody's that go through different levers, don't
they? Yeah.
So how are you explaining
that? I believe it would have happened, you know. That's how I explain that one. Now, the idea of a bodhisattva there are such things as bodhisattvas also in the Theravada Buddhism, but basically it's a Mahayana idea. I don't really know all that much about Mahayana Buddhism, but there are different ways that these things are explained. They are explained in different ways depending on which kind of Mahayana teaching you go to and whether you go to Theravada teaching. So it really depends on the kind of branch of Buddhism and all these kind of things. But the Bodhisattva idea is sometimes it is said to be that you don't awaken at all. There's no awakening. So the Bodhisattva actually doesn't have these experiences. So the Bodhisattva hasn't actually ended ignorance, right? It's still ignorant, and you are kind of postponing your own awakening until you help everybody else. That is one way that the Bodhisattva thing works. But it's, you know, I have to admit, I don't really understand that, because how can you help others if you're still ignorant yourself? First of all, you have to actually achieve some wisdom. When the wisdom is deep, then, you know, you can help others much better. So that is one way. Another way that the Bodhisattva idea works, some people say, is that you actually attain awakening and then you postpone you continue living as an awakened being, but you continue taking a rebirth. That's the other idea. But I don't know how that could work, because you have cut off the root of rebirth, so it can't really be possible. And there is the Theravada idea of the Bodhisattva. And the Theravada idea of the Bodhisattva is just a person who is trying to reach awakening. That's all it is. So, you know, you could argue you're a Bodhisattva. I don't know if you're trying to reach awakening, but if you are, maybe you're a Bodhisattva as well then. So this is just the Bodhisattva there actually means a person who is intent on awakening here. Somebody is moving in that direction. So in early Buddhism, you make a distinction between the Buddha and the Arahant. It's really just the Buddha who is a Bodhisattva. while he's intent on awakening, and the Arahant is never really called the Bodhisattva. The Arahant is just a disciple who follows the same path within him.
But I also meant this as a sort of teacher or someone helping him out. There's some volition there as well.
Of course, yeah.
How do you explain that?
Well, there's different types of volition. I'm not claiming to be an Arahant, by the way, so maybe that might have some dubious volitions still. So one possible volition is, I'm going to be a teacher because, wow, it's really great to be a teacher, it's going to be nice for me, flatter your ego or whatever. That's one possibility. Unwholesome, right? Bad. Not very good. And another one could be out of compassion. People ask you to teach, okay, so I will teach because they ask me. Not because you particularly want to do it or you don't kind of dislike it either, you just do it because people ask it. And then you make the best out of it when it happens. Right? So these are ordinary volitions, the kind of volition that everybody has, the volitions that are either wholesome or unwholesome. You actually still create karma in that particular sense. But even if you are an Arahant, even if you are fully awakened, it doesn't mean that you don't have any volition. The volition are on a different level. So if you are, for me, or for ordinary people, when you have a volition, it's always based on ignorance. For that reason, that volition creates karma. But if a volition is not based on ignorance, then that volition has nothing to do with establishing consciousness at any level. It's a neutral volition, which only has to do with a particular situation in the present moment. Okay, an Arahant, people ask you to teach, you have compassion, okay, so you do it. But it's not actually a activity which actually creates karma anymore. Because it's not an inclination of the mind that stays there. It's just a temporary thing which happens while you're doing the teaching. It's called kriya karma, a functional karma, according to the commentaries of the Abhidhamma.
And there's no self in the teaching, it's just compassion.
That's the ideal, isn't it? That's the ideal. There's no self, there's compassion exactly there. It's never nice. If there is too much self when somebody teaches, it's not so nice. It doesn't feel good. It feels much nicer if there's very little self there. You can just feel that when whoever it is that teaches, the less self there is, the more powerful in a sense is the teaching. Yeah? So there's something very beautiful about that. But it's difficult to do that fully, 100%. Okay. Okay, so next question. As a Mahavi, could you please explain whether right view automatically results from meditation? Do you get automatically right view? What you get is you get better view, right? Right view, like everything else, is a gradual thing. You start off, this is what right view and delusion, avidya, are very closely related to each other. So you start off with the wrong view. Wrong view is very much like being ignorant, being deluded, right? So you start off, and then as delusion subsides, because you're practicing the right way, because all the defilements are subsiding, of course your mind becomes more clear. And to that extent, you actually have more right view, less delusion, more clarity about what is going on. That actually is more right view. So yes, if you meditate in the right way, it depends how you meditate, right? If you meditate thinking about all kinds of things that you shouldn't think about while you meditate, and you end up more restless and more agitated than when you started out, of course, it is not going to give rise to more right view. But if the meditation is going in the right way, yes, it is doing that. So it's all about how it does. So the path of Buddhism is interesting because you are kind of moving more and more towards right view. You get more and more insight, right? Gradually. But then there also comes a point when you have the breakthrough. And you make kind of a quantum leap, right? So it's both. People often ask, is enlightenment, is it gradual or is it instantaneous? And the reality is it's both gradual and instantaneous. You need to gradually develop the path to actually reach a particular point where all the defilements are gone. And then, when you eventually have that final insight, then it is instantaneous. You make this quantum leap, right? Wow. Ah, now I understand it. There's a gradualness together with a quantum leap at the end. So right view is established slowly until finally, bang, it is established completely. you know, you look at the world in a different way after that. Then. Okay. Ooh, okay, so let's see if I can decipher the handwriting here. If five khandhas are interdependent on consciousness cyclically, do we need to rethink existence as relative, i.e. nothing exists independently? Yes, that is exactly right, that's the whole point, yeah. Known only responsibility based on experience, observation, accuracy in another sense, or epistemologically relative to the knower. Okay. No. With modes qualifying existence. Okay. You want to try to explain what you're trying to say? Yeah.
Can you
just
think a little more about what existence is?
Khandhas, okay. So what existence actually is?
So why are khandhas relatively?
The khandhas exist relatively. What the Buddha has to say about this is that he doesn't say that things don't exist. He says that they exist in a dependently arisen way. That's the whole point. So he doesn't say that there is no such thing as existence. What he said is that there is existence. That existence is a changeable thing. Yeah? It's always changing, always moving, always, you know, always metamorphosing from one thing to another one, right? So that sort of existence exists, but not the kind of existence that we feel by default is there, which is an existence which is more permanent or more settled. Yeah? Yeah. So, and this is one of the nice things about the Buddha. He doesn't actually deny existence in a certain way. It's just that it's not as if the Buddhism has no ontology. Not to talk about ontology. There is a kind of ontology there, if you want to use philosophical terminology, but it's a different kind of ontology. It's an existence on a different level from what we're used to now. Okay. This is another of your questions. I recognize your handwriting now, so you're moving away.
This is pretty bad.
Sorry?
This
was
a good
one. It's a good one, is it? Okay. Question to understand. Essence.
Existence.
Existence, is it? Cohesion versus completeness. Okay. If conditionality is necessary and sufficient between factors, is it also transitive on the subsequent factors? Is it transitive on the subsequent factors? What does that mean then?
So does it self-propagates from the first factor through all 12 factors?
The self-propagates?
So people are asking, is it useful to try and think of the cohesivity as one factor depending on its predecessor? Or is it useful to think of the factors propagating throughout all the 12 factors, you know, so an illusory self will propagate through to craving, you know, craving false doctrine of self.
Okay, I see. It's like a transition, basically. Yeah.
So you've got 11 relationships. So you've got 11 factorials. To possibly think about it. So it's more cohesive. It's
simpler to think about just
the predecessor, but maybe more realistic
to
think about how the illusions propagate all the way through.
Well, it is, of course. It is propagated all the way through. And the thing is that, remember, that the idea of 12 factors, one leading to another one, is just a method of showing a particular system. But take, for example, ignorance, avidya. It's like an artificial setup, if you like, right? To show how all these things actually, how the system works. But a factor like avijja is there with every of the other factors. It's not just at the beginning. So if you take avijja, ignorance, it is there with craving, for example, right? Craving is right there with craving all the time. It is also there with clinging. It's there with all the other, it's part of the whole path, so to speak. But to be able to disentangle this and to understand the general principles. You have to make up an artificial setup so that these things are put, you know, pulled apart in this particular way. So craving doesn't exist without avijja being there at that moment when it happens. But it's also the fact that avijja established and made craving possible in the first place. So there's many things happening here. It's actually quite much more, as you say, much more holistic than what it may seem. So it's rather, it's a bit of an artificial way of pulling the factors apart in this way. So you know, we talk about these things as three lifetimes, but in reality, all the 12 factors also exist in this lifetime. I was talking about, you know, going from birth to birth, but all the 12 factors also exist right this in this life. It's not as if, you know, I had avijja or ignorance in the past life. Now I have craving, but not avijja. That's not how it works. All the factors are here now. But to be able to have a clear exposition about what's going on, you have to pull them apart in this way. And there's also feedback loops in this thing as well, right? So for example, when you crave and then you cling to certain things, that clinging in itself intensifies the craving. You're holding on to things. And that would then feed back to the craving before it. Whatever you do, whenever you crave something or you have upadana, whatever, and that leads to certain actions, that also affects the entire mental composition of the mind, which is at the beginning, which is the fourth factor of the arising, which is your experience of the world. So it is actually very complicated. All of these things are continuously affecting each other, all of these factors. But to understand the basic principle, you have to pull them apart this way. That's really what it is about.
Yes, it's no wonder we're disappointed, because
there's
all these factors, two levels impacting on.
Yeah, right, exactly. So that's why you have to be very careful, and you have to kind of focus on certain aspects of this. Otherwise, this gets too complicated. So you have to focus on, you know, certain things that actually are useful, and that's what the Buddha is doing here. Was there anything more about not in here?
Or? Yeah,
forget the rest of it. Yeah. Okay, very good. Okay, with no personal responsibility, everything is due to conditions. How is there personal karma? Okay, so I had explained that, but I can maybe, you know, try again. So the idea is that it is personal in the sense that there is a stream of consciousness, right? If you think about yourself in this life, who are you as a person? And this is kind of why it is called the middle way. It is neither the same person nor a different person. It is you just moving on through life. And as you move on through life, you are changing continuously. Who are you in this life? In this life, are you the same person that you were 20 years ago, or are you a different person? And the reality is, it's a bit of both, right? You're a bit the same, a bit different. The body has certainly changed. The mind is changing all the time, right? You are not thinking the same way now that you did 20 years ago, 30 years ago, or 10 years ago, or whatever it is. So in this very life, the way you are seeing yourself right now, there is changeability. And the idea is basically the same, right? Across lifetimes. It's exactly the same thing that happens across lifetimes. So if you were to remember a past life, you would be able to recognize yourself. You said, that was me there in the past life. And the reason that you will be able to recognize yourself is because of this principle of continuity. There is no kind of abrupt change suddenly into somebody else, but it's actually you can recognize yourself going through this. So for this reason, there is also karma which adheres to that stream of consciousness. And as I said, you can experience this in this very life, right? You do something bad, feel what it feels like. Experience that. And you will feel when you do something which is nice to somebody else, you will actually feel bad about that. It doesn't feel good. Somehow it feels kind of rotten. It's like pulling yourself down, as I was saying before, lowering your consciousness, making life more miserable for yourself. And when you feel that, you can feel karma in this very life. That's exactly the same thing which happens across lifetimes. It's exactly the same thing. Once you have lowered that level of consciousness, you carry that level of consciousness with you into the future. And the force of those creative forces in the past, they have a certain force. And as long as that force is still operating, you will stay at that level until eventually that hold will kind of release. And that's where you can then get reborn in higher existence again. So that, you know, it lasts for a certain period of time, going across lifetimes. It's important not to be too kind of hung up in one lifetime or another, because really what happens from one lifetime to another is just the same as what is happening already in this life. It's just a bit more dramatic, right? You move into a completely new existence, so it seems more dramatic, but actually all of those things are already happening in this life on a much smaller scale, in a sense. And then when you get reborn, it's happening on the larger scale, but the same principles apply. So you can know the laws of karma in that sense. Yes? Maybe, perhaps, yeah. So that's the idea you have. Okay, so let's do one more, and then let's call it take a break, and let's see what happens. Okay, if there is no end, why not beginning? Is that the question? If there is no end, why not? If there is an end, okay, of course. If there is an end, why not a beginning? If there is an end, why not a beginning? Okay, well, I think maybe there isn't an end, right? Are you sure there is an end? Maybe it depends on what you do, if there is an end or not. So an end, maybe not. If you really think that there is an end, that would be what you call annihilationism. Everything just stops when you die. But whether there is an end or not depends on your practice, depends on what you do. So if you do things in the right way, then there will be an end. So the end itself is conditional. It's not an absolute certainty that you will end with something. So why not the beginning? Well, maybe there could be a beginning as well, but what the Buddha says, and I think it kind of, to me, it sounds really right, he says that when you look back in time, you always find another cause for something else. The idea that something just kind of arises out of nothing seems strange. And you might count, well, that things kind of just cease into nothing might seem strange as well. But the point is that, you know, once ignorance is there, and once we are actually acting in a certain way, there is no obvious reason why that ignorance should come into existence in the first place. But it seems fairly clear how that ignorance can be eliminated to understand things according to reality. So, you know, the starting point is more difficult to explain than the end point. The end point comes because it is possible to rectify a problem that is there, but the start point, there is no way to really establish why that starting point should have arisen in the first place. Why would ignorance arise? It doesn't make any sense unless you were not ignorant before, then it wouldn't exist, right? So there isn't really any way of answering that question, why ignorance would arise. But the most important thing, I think, and this is what I like about the Buddha's teaching, is that they are pragmatic. The Buddha doesn't say that there isn't any beginning. He doesn't say that it goes on endlessly. All he says is that there is no discoverable beginning. Right? You go back in time, you go back and back and back, there's nothing to become discovering. So it may be, even from the Buddha's point of view, perhaps there is a beginning, just that I haven't seen it. But the way I would interpret it, and I would understand this, is basically that what seems most logical to me is that in fact there is no beginning. We can go back, and it just goes on and on and on. The idea of a first cause, right? The first cause which started everything, doesn't seem logical to me. Because that cause itself must have come into being. How did that arise? Right? If we take God to be the first cause of everything, well, what about God? Isn't that just kind of explaining things away in an unsatisfactory way? You might as well say the universe was there in the beginning. What is the difference between saying God was there in the beginning and the universe was there in the beginning? There's no difference. It's just a different entity, right? God is a bit more mysterious, perhaps. That kind of doesn't solve the problem. So this is what I, again, think is marvelous about the Buddha's teaching. It seems to actually work in ways where many other teachings may not work quite as well.